Today on Happiness Patrol, Dueling Marvins.
What are you doing in a car park? They say to me, parking cars.
I hate that door. All the doors on this ship have a lovely and sunny disposition. It is their pleasure to open for you, and a joy to close with the knowledge of a job well done. I hate that door.
Hello, sweetie.
All the straight listeners have just come in their pants.
I was waiting for the poontang moment, and I think I just got it.
That's a big thick book right there. That took her a lot of hard time to walk around with that big old thick brick thing. And she read all of that one and read another one that was just as thick.
Depending on how much beer I had, I spent half my time either looking at her cleavage or looking at her purple hair. So, you know, both were very impressive.
I'm about to stick the single most vile concoction down my throat ever.
Stand by for action.
You're listening to the Happiness Patrol, and I'm Sam Stone.
Come in, Happiness Patrol. Hello, Happiness Patrol. Come in. Hello, Tara.
Hello.
Tara.
Hello.
Tara.
Hello. Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Tara.
Here.
Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Welcome to today's Happiness Patrol. And hello, Tara. Tara, you're coming from us again from another remote locale.
Hello. Yes, I am still in Bellevue, Washington. I am in the back of the brand spanking new Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy.
Cool.
And I don't doubt that at some point in the proceedings, David will come along and tell me to keep the profanity down.
Oh, okay.
It's a family job.
The DH, your dear husband, so I do understand.
The DH is out manning the front desk, and there's a whole bunch of children in the shop. So
that's probably
I've been consigned to a back office.
That's probably a very good thing. So yeah. Dale, yeah. You there, Dale?
Yes, what Dale. Do you want? Go away, I'm ill.
Dale is currently a little under the weather, as you can probably
tell. What do you mean a little under the weather? I got worn to the bloody brom by death.
I bet you can do a great Tom Baker this time now, huh?
I can do a very good cyber leader.
Oh, do your cyber leader.
Promise.
Do your cyber leader.
Have no validity. When the tower is in our hands, he will be destroyed.
Say. Excellent.
That's brilliant.
And speaking of, we don't have Leela today, so we'll say adios to Leela today because she is currently under the weather, a little bit like Dale, but at least Dale, you know, was able to Skype in for crying out loud.
Yeah, Leela.
But we do love you, Leela, and we'll see you next week, hon. So you better get better, okay?
I love you.
But in the meantime, we have. Excellent special guest today. We have author Sam Stone. Hello.
Hi there, Lewis.
Yay!
Hi, Tom.
Welcome to the Happiness Patrol,
Hello, Sam. Hello.
Oh, thank you. I'm very pleased to be here today.
And apparently from some heavy breathing in the background, I believe you have somebody else there with you. Is that correct?
I do indeed. I've got my other half here.
Yes, mistress.
My Renfield.
Yes, mistress.
And those of you who are not in the know,
keep him away from the bugs. Huh?
her other half is the legendary Whovian. I'm going to use the word Whovian. Yes, I am. Mr. David Howe. David, hello and welcome.
Hello, Tara. Hello, Lewis. Hello, Dale. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
Well, it's great to have you guys on the Happiness Patrol. You doing all right?
Yeah, it's fabulous to be here. Yeah, we're doing great. We're dialing in from sunny North Wales, not a million miles away from Dale, but a million miles away from the other two guys. Yeah.
Can you stop sounding so
you're
healthy?
Oh, you're hell and gone from where I am.
I'm so sorry.
Stop sounding healthy.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dale. I'm sorry. But you know why? It's because I have all the bugs in a little box, and I like them. And when they stop moving, I eat them one at a time.
Okay, there's our Right, gotcha. So today we're going to have a fun time.
Today on the Happiness Patrol, Bug Eaters.
We're going to be talking to Sam and David about vampires and other things, and Dale will just be amazingly wonderful, Dale, and
oh, bug off and start the damn show.
So stay tuned and hang on. The Happiness Patrol starts right now. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to the Happiness Patrol. Today on the Happiness Patrol, Miss Sam Stone, authoress of vampire novels, and we've invited her here to help us review and talk about The Vampires of Venice, the latest episode that we watched this weekend. And, boy, I had a good time. And welcome, Sam. Welcome to the Happiness Patrol.
Oh, hi there, Lewis. I'm really glad to be here today.
So, so what was your first impression of The Vampires of Venice?
Oh, are you ready for this?
I'm ready. I'm totally ready.
I liked it, but my first impression was that I wasn't as excited by it as the other episodes, to be honest. I was a little bit. I really wanted to be my heart pounding again, as I have been in some of the episodes. I think I was a bit spoilt last week.
Oh, yeah. Last week was fantastic. That's for sure.
Yeah, just amazing. And I think the whole thing has been a kind of a roller coaster ride the last few weeks with the new Who. So I did feel that I didn't have that sort of palpitation feeling with this episode, unfortunately, but it was still very good.
Now, Sam, you are an expert on vampires, okay? That's why we have you here. So
I'm very well-read on them, yes.
Tell me this. Were you a little disappointed when the vampires simply turned out to be fish from space?
Yes.
Yes. I was too, just a little bit. So
I wanted them to stay vampires, because I think that's kind of alien enough anyway.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And plus, you know, there was the other great vampire story that Tom Baker and Lala Ward did, State of Decay, which was part of the Key to Time. Trilogy?
East Space Trilogy.
Oh, I'm sorry. The East Space. Oh, thank you, Dale. Dale, I'm glad you're there. See, this is Sam. This is why I have Dale around. I surround myself with brains, so I don't have to be one myself. So, but anyway.
Episodes to remember, though.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's for sure. And speaking of brains and episodes to remember, why don't you introduce us to your other half that you have here, Sam?
I've got with me today. My very special Renfield, David Ahow, who is, I'm sure, well known as I don't need to really introduce so much.
Hello.
But.
Hello. Yes, Doctor Who writer, historian, runner of Telos Publishing, gondola driver, and all-round good egg.
Well, that's very nice. Now I was told, David, that and I looked this up. You've got like 20 something books or so all about Doctor Who.
I mean, yeah, I think it's over 30 now. I mean, I must admit, I lose track as well. And then you see the compiler in me as I do the House Transcendental Toy Box book. You know, the guide to all the Doctor merchandise. Mm-hmm. That. In and says, yeah, but what about paperback editions? Does that count as a separate book, or is that the same book? So I think it's about 30 original books that I've done, which is kind of cool over the years.
Nice. You know, here's the bit that I read online about you, David, that really kind of touched me. I hear that you're a big collector of Doctor Who memorabilia.
Yes, indeed, I am. Yes.
Can I just interrupt on that one?
Hang on.
Collector isn't in it. The house is a museum.
What have you done?
We've got a very big house, an 8-bedroom house, and it's mostly full of Doctor Who.
To be fair, he was the writer of House Transcendental Toy Box. He does need it for reference.
Absolutely.
That's what he keeps telling me.
Yeah, no, I've got a very large collection of stuff. Which, to slightly contradict Sam, I mean, it is kind of mostly in one room in the house.
Yeah.
Which we kind of give over to
if you say so.
It is. Stop it, you. Which is kind of shelves, display units and stuff like that. So yeah.
When you say it's in one room in the house, do you mean the bedroom, as in all of them just under one name?
No. It's one of the spare bedrooms. It's basically given over to be a big collection room with, you know, display cabinets and storage and shelves and all that kind of thing. And then there's a few bits and bobs kind of standing around the rest of the house as we're sort of sorting out other rooms and things and haven't quite decided yet, you know, where everything's going to end up. But, you know, we'll get there. It'll be fine.
Exactly.
This will be the Dalek room, and this will be the Cybermen room.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've been persuading Sam to try and move the bedroom into the closet so that we could use the bedroom, but she's not having it.
Is the closet bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, so that can happen?
It's exactly the opposite, strangely.
Yeah. Oh, no.
So, David?
Yes, hi.
You'll have to tell me something. What was your impression of The Vampires of Venice?
Well, I actually quite enjoyed it. I found it quite... it rattled along at a good old pace, mm-hmm. Which I quite liked. I like the way that the vampires were done in it, although I was a bit disappointed that they ended up being fish people. I thought that was a bit kind of gay. Overall it was all right. Overall it was all right, but
uh-huh.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. So, you might want to repeat that one, David.
So overall it was okay, but I, you know, do you agree with Sam that after like the last two episodes of probably one of the scariest monsters in Doctor Who, the Weeping Angels, that this was maybe a bit of a letdown?
Oh, not really. I mean, mm-hmm. I actually was kind of disappointed by the second part of the Angels in the Forest or whatever it was called. I didn't feel as though it kind of went anywhere, really. It sort of all petered out a bit. I mean, it's lovely to look at. Lovely to look at, beautiful to behold. But the plot seemed to be for a different story or something. So
right,
I was
right.
a bit disappointed with that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the Dalek thing was kind of horrible.
Oh, goodness.
I wasn't that taken with the Song of the Space Whale.
Uh-huh.
I like that.
It's kind of... No, I quite enjoyed it as a sort of a self-contained, quite a nice little romp. Lots uh-huh. of good performances.
Right.
Vampires, I thought, were quite scary. I thought, you know, again, you know, any 10-year-old kid with a 12-year-old sister was going to kind of think that she was a vampire by the end of that story, which I thought was kind of cool.
That's very funny.
I mean, it had lots of nice little moments in it, and nice little bits in it. I thought that the setting was brilliant. I thought uh-huh. visually it was stunning. I think they did a really, really good job on it.
Yeah, they did.
I actually really enjoyed it. As cool. I said, the only thing was I would have liked them to have been, if not vampires, but not fish people.
But
leech people or some kind of alien parasitical thing that was actually... You know, doing what it wanted to do, rather than, you know,
something more vampire-esque than actually.
And I must admit, I kept getting confused watching it as well, because it was like, so all the women came through the thing and all the men died. So, but hang on, all the men are in the water, so they didn't die. Well, hang on, there's one running around with the queen, so. They didn't all die then, so how come he can run around?
Well,
and none of the others?
That's going to be a question. That's going to be a question for Toby Whithouse. So,
yeah, but I did enjoy it. I did enjoy it. I thought it was a jolly good romp.
Cool. Now, Dale.
Yes.
I know you were feeling a little ill when you got this, but what did you
cackled? Who cackled?
Our resident
that was
cackler.
Me.
The resident cackler. Me. So, what was your first impression, Dale?
My first impression was Marvin at the beginning of the show.
Oh, yeah.
It was.
Okay, I liked it. Okay, now, a couple of things all put straight. It was the females that died out when they got here. The males survived because they're in the water. That's where they're producing new females and giving them blood transfusions.
Yeah, that is right.
Right, so...
The princess, queen one.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she's kind of...
So why didn't she die?
Yeah.
Because she's the queen and she can't.
Oh, okay.
I'm the bloody queen, mate. I rule. Anyway. Sorry, wrong episode. I thought Helen McCrory was just stunning. Everything she
was fantastic.
Ruled.
She was great, yeah.
I loved her voice.
Matt's doctor.
Her voice was just lovely.
Matt's doctor is just... bloody sublime. I love that man to bits. He's so cool. And Rory, good job I brought this and that tiny little torch. He goes and pulls out a bloody lightsaber from his pocket. And I'm like, jeez.
Yeah, a torch? This is a torch.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was great. I loved it. I have to say, like the rest of you, I wasn't too massively keen on the fact they turned out to be intergalactic crayfish. Mostly because you can see it with the queen. She had that wonderful, almost that ruff around her neck that turned into her ruff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But if they weren't actually wearing proper clothes and all the clothes are part of the perception filter, A, why did she take off her clothes at the end?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
B, exactly. why did the prince have a hat that he kept taking on and off? I'm thinking, you're a fish. Why are you wearing a hat? Anyway, so that irritates
me. Well, he's a fish. This is the first time he's ever gotten to wear a hat.
Yeah,
he's
very
excited
if
about
I
that.
Was a fish, I'd be loving wearing a hat. Yeah, absolutely.
Mom, can I come with you? I want to wear a hat.
God. Yeah. I mean, this Toby Whithouse, he's really good at writing just these one-liner sort of things, these comical bits. I mean, and it was great to see all the comedy in this because it really, you know, I don't know. It was just a nice combination of nice comic moments and little dark moments too. So
I thought at first that there might have been a bit too much comedy, and I mentioned this to Sam actually yesterday as we were watching the episode, that maybe the comedy had been increased because they actually thought that viewers might be a bit too scared by a very dark kind of vampire and creepy pale girls kind of creeping around in dark cellars kind of thing. So it's probably worked in its favour in some respects to sort of lighten the mood a lot.
Yeah, I think it
went a lot.
Yeah.
And Toby Whithouse, he's the Being Human guy, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So and
School Reunion.
Oh, that's right. He wrote School Reunion,
which of course is more, well, it's bat people disguised as humans, and this is fish people disguised as vampires. So it's that whole perception filter changing and, you know, being something it's not thing again.
What a great plot gimmick, you know.
Yeah, I was just going to reference Being Human again for it's also got a lot of awful good one-liners in it.
Yeah, it has. It's
a very smart show if you get a chance to see it. So,
and very gritty, which I really like, because it is very, very dark and very gritty.
Can we go back to the Doctor being the Pope now?
Oh, the Doctor being the Pope. That was quite funny.
I'd like to talk about His Holiness. Let's talk.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was very funny that he goes, wait, Casanova, he hasn't been born yet. I hope I don't run. I'm glad I'm not going to run into him. I owe him a chicken. I was like, what?
I actually
stack of David Tennant as Casanova at that point.
That's what I thought.
I
thought a cameo of him walking in the background would be fantastic.
Or running would have been more appropriate.
Yeah. So what, series two of Matt Smith, we've now got David Tennant playing Casanova, mowing the Doctor a chicken or vice versa. Yeah.
I actually really like the fact that it was set in Venice as well, because my first book, Killing Kiss, my vampires are in Venice as well. So there's quite an interest for me there.
And I did a lot of time period as well, isn't it?
Definitely similar to the 16th century.
Now tell me this, Sam. Why did you set your vampires in Venice? And when you found out that this particular episode was supposed to be set in Venice with vampires, did you go, wait a minute?
I did,
did my research by I wrote my first novel for my dissertation, my master's degree, in 2005, finished my master's in 2006, went to Venice for research at Christmas 2005, and so I was kind of like really in love with the place. I don't know if any of you saw Confidential, but they did Francesco da Mosta. Was interviewed by Toby, and I thought, I read all his books, and you know, I did the same journey that Toby did, which was really interesting to see that he was kind of doing the same thing that I'd done. And I don't know why it was, but just it seemed to be such a romantic place.
And you also loved the musical opera element of it.
I did.
And also
did,
the Borgias, which is the boat.
Absolutely. And the first book is very much about Giulio Caccini's fictional nephew. And so opera was a huge element. Music's a really big part of my life. And so all of that to do with Italy and Venice itself just seemed natural that I would incorporate all those things into that first book.
Oh, very cool.
So it's fascinating, really, that somebody else made the connection in another way.
And you also had the Pope in it as well, coming back to the Doctor being the Pope. Yeah, it's a bit freaky to think of your kind of Borgia Pope.
It is, because, my vampire Gabrielle was originally bitten by Lucrezia Borgia in Venice, in the Doge's palace, where she seduces him. And, she's obviously the daughter of Pope Alexander.
That must have been a Thursday, because that sort of thing always happens on Thursdays.
Always happens on a Thursday, doesn't it? Always.
Oh, my goodness. Chickens ahoy! So, I thought this episode was great because there was a lot of chickens in it. Yes. Chickens and an old lady and goat.
It was a very chickeny episode.
It was very chicken. You know, every time something would happen, there'd be a cutaway to a chicken going...
But you see, if the doctor owes Casanova a chicken, you could have just
mentioned it. Yeah, there was a whole chicken theme. There was an underlying chicken theme to this entire thing. So even with Rory. Ooh.
So you can talk about that's the theme of this episode of the Happiness Patrol, the chickens. Underlying chicken theme.
No, you just say chickens ahoy.
See, this episode we didn't get to see Amy's crag.
No.
That was a bit of a relief.
Wait a minute. No. Amy's crack is running around eating up whole worlds now.
Yeah.
It's voracious.
It's amazing. The voracious.
It was too busy to be in the episode. It was eating up whole
Amy's
world,
voracious so. Crack. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yep.
It's a nightmare. So what is this thing with the silence then? What do you guys think that's all about?
I don't know, but I thought it was pretty cheesy the way they threw it in at the end. So
it was a what?
A bit cheesy.
Oh, a bit cheesy. Yeah. It was our sound mix has gone wrong.
Yeah, really.
You know, I beg to disagree that I actually quite like that silence aspect then. And I mean, it really did. I thought that was more freaky than all the hissing vampires. That complete silence. That was, the world could end at this point. And I think it leaves so much to the imagination that is far more scary sometimes than things we actually see.
Yeah, but I mean, it gets me thinking, if Amy's crack is so voracious and is just gobbling up kind of whole worlds and everything, I mean, does this mean that everywhere that we've seen Amy's crack, once the doctor's moved on, stop it, sir. Once the doctor's moved on from it, does it then kind of gobble up the world? So it's like, does Churchill no longer exist?
We'll have to wait. We'll have to wait until...
Because the whole of the space whale kind of eaten up in Amy's crack. I mean, the angels went into the crack and they all ceased to exist. So, I mean, what's going on here? I mean, I think, it's just fascinating.
I'd like to know how many times we can get crack in this.
Oh, we can get it in as many times. We got quite a bit of stuff in last time, too. So.
And there'll be a prize for anyone who can say how many times we've been to crack in
These vampires, this episode, there were some scary bits in this. And what really kind of got to me, and I wonder if anybody else saw this, when Amy is like infiltrating the sisterhood, the school for the girls there, boy oh boy, I don't know about you, but it took me right back to the Hammer films that I used to see.
I knew we were gonna go there.
I mean, really, and I was thinking when I was watching that, I was like. Wow, that's very Hammer-like, And then I was expecting to see Christopher Lee.
It's Hammer time.
But yeah, it's Hammer time. But you know what's funny about that? That was before I watched later. After I watched the episode a couple of times, I watched The Confidential, and they mentioned the same thing, and I was like, oh, how funny! The director did. The director.
But I mentioned this to Lewis. I mentioned this to Sam. The creepy vampire girls actually goes all the way back to the Universal Dracula.
The decent one.
the girls in white in the cellar kind of thing.
Yeah, the decent one. We like Dracula, but we like Dracula.
But the thing that they picked up from the 58 Hammer Dracula was of course the hissing through the teeth, which
I had a problem with that yesterday because it's corny and I think it's dated and I just think it would have been, you know, specifically because of the idea of the silence that is starting to feature quite heavily now in the episodes. I felt that it would have been so much cooler had she walked up those stairs to complete silence.
Uh-huh.
And instead the girls were hissing and showing their teeth and it was just all kind of a bit sad.
Oh.
I didn't like that. Oh. Maybe it's a good thing because David really did like the girls.
Well, I enjoyed it too. Well, I liked it.
I'm sorry, I liked it.
Yeah, I love the girls very, very much.
They were great.
I've never been a fan of hissing vampires. I don't think vampires should go around sounding like bloody snakes.
I don't see why they'd have to. I mean, it just seems a little bit bizarre when they're so intelligent and they're interacting so well that they would suddenly resort to hissing at people.
I mean, what I said is just if you've got those prosthetic teeth in, it's the only thing you can do.
Yeah, so pretty much.
But there's one scene in it.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, Dale. I was going to say, there's one scene in it which I absolutely love. You only see it for a fraction of a second. It's where the vampires appear at the window when they're all in the room.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the blonde vampire with her kind of hands clawed, as I'm doing at the moment, sort of floating into view for a fraction of a second. And that is just so crazy.
Yeah. And then Rory says, aren't we on the second floor? And you just think, oh, Jesus. Yeah, that's brilliant because that reminds me of Salem's Lot.
Yes.
So funny.
Which is a damn creep.
Well, you know, during that window scene, the doctor says the funniest thing. He goes, blimey, fish from space have never been so buxom. And I was like, oh, that's hilarious.
I wonder how many other kind of vampire films they were referencing. I mean, I must admit, Sam and I, you know, we've seen an awful lot of them.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that many more references, but of course you always wonder how many they kind of put in.
Oh yeah.
Spot, you know.
Yeah.
But I saw that Solemn's Lot moment as well, and I thought that, and the whole Dracula's Brides thing, of course, and you know, and that, of course the scene where the doctor's looking in the mirror and they're not in the mirror and they're in the room kind of thing is also very nicely done.
Yeah.
And they're all speaking in unison, which they never explain the speaking in unison as well.
That was really creepy. That was really good.
It was all a bit of a disappointment that they weren't vampires, that they were just kind of crayfish disguised fish. You know, no matter how good the CGI is, and it was very good, you know, it just was a disappointment.
It's funny that, because I just love vampires anyway so very much, that doesn't mean, folks, that I really believe in them. But yes, I just
I do. I dated one for 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
Pale creepy girl.
Yeah, give me a pale. Give me five pale creepy girls any day. I'm ready.
Yeah, I didn't date a pale creepy girl.
And I guess I would have just loved them to have done that, but explored that mythology a little bit more in an alien way rather than it was always a little bit too easy to make it another alien. I guess.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well. And again, I've forgotten where we were. You mentioned the vampires there, Lewis. I mean,
yeah, the hammer influence on that scene where Amy gets in there and, like, you know, she's going up and she's like going. The other really, really spooky scene to me is she's got that candle and she's creeping through there to open up the hatch for the doctor and Rory to come through. And she opens up the hatch, you know, and then she turns around the fellow just sort of pops out of nowhere, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's old, it's cliche, but you know what?
Oh, I like that.
It gets me every single time. And that was pretty spooky.
Weren't the sets good?
Very good.
I obviously, I don't know how much of it they actually did on location and how much of it was sets, but, you know, whatever it was, it really worked because I was very convinced by the location. I mean, watching it on Confidential was also quite an eye-opener as to how they did it, and you know, it's brilliant.
Very clever.
Now, where was the set, Tara?
Croatia. They filmed in Croatia.
Oh, it was in Croatia. Yeah. Okay.
And having been to Venice, I think that it was in Venice. I thought it was really convincing.
But they did some shots in Venice and then overlaid them with Croatia. But what I meant, guys, was like the castle interiors and the sets, like, you know, the hatch that you mentioned there. And
yeah.
It was all just very, very genuine. It just felt right, the whole thing.
Oh, so, yeah, and that was a big part of making the whole episode believable.
The costumes were just first rate. The sets and the costumes were just first rate for this episode. Just 10 for 10 for the sets and costumes.
Now,
just fantastic. And the cinematography. Some of the shots were just beautiful. Stunning, breathtaking, gorgeous.
I loved the shot of the Doctor and Rory and co. coming down the tunnel with the lights in the far distance, with the rest of it's all black.
Oh yeah,
brilliant.
Why down the tunnel? I loved that shot. Brilliant.
Yeah, it was framed really nice. Now, speaking of costume design, is Louise Page working on this series or not?
No, she's not. She was one of the ones let go. They should have let Murray Gold go. They let the wrong ones go.
Ooh.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh.
David.
I can't stand the music. I really can't stand the music.
I don't think it was too bad in this one.
No, this one was all right.
It can be, because you never mentioned it once this time, so it must have been all right.
Okay, David, when you're saying something strong like that, we usually try to back it up with some sort of reasoning there. Why exactly do you? What you don't have? You don't have.
Glad Lena's not in the room.
Yeah, really.
That'll be a first.
Oh, absolutely.
Now.
But when you say you don't like the music, what about the music is it that turns you off?
What I don't like in particular is that whoever it is, and I don't know if it's Murray Gold himself or the production team or somebody else, but there seems to be this desire to underpin every single scene with music which kind of tells you what you're supposed to be feeling at this point. Mm-hmm. I absolutely loathe his choral kind of thing, that whenever anything happens that it's in the remotely awe-inspiring or anything, you get, oh, come on, and you think, oh, for goodness sake. And the whole of the first episode with the fish custard, and it's got this stupid, annoying, jokey music over the whole thing. It's like, all right already, we get it. It's, you know, it's meant to be lighthearted. It's obvious. You don't have to be, you know, beating me around the head with this wall-to-wall music, mm-hmm. you know, which is just annoying.
I don't know whether universally in the UK, a lot of people say this as well to me. A lot of my friends and family have said the same. They often feel like the music is overpowering the dialogue.
The sound mix is all wrong in the UK when it's transmitted.
So
Now, doesn't this sound like me when we were talking about the first episode when I mentioned the music?
It wasn't because
I dislike the music. I think Murray Gold is excellent. I just think that in some parts, especially of the 11th Hour, and it might have been just the copy of the episode that I was watching, but it seemed like the music was a little high in the mix.
I think it's too much.
In fairness to this episode, I actually didn't.
No.
I didn't become aware of it as being excessive. So maybe they're taking on board some of the feedback they've been getting.
Because it's when you find yourself being annoyed by the music rather than being carried along by the narrative.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's like everything in television and film production. Yeah. It's working perfectly if you don't notice it. Yeah.
Yes,
if you
absolutely.
Don't notice that the costumes are wrong, or if you don't notice the music, or if you don't notice that the sets wobble, or if you don't notice that such and such was anachronistic or something, yeah, that's when they've got it right. It's when you get pulled out of the narrative and, you know, you're bludgeoned about the head, and that just doesn't work for me.
Or you're distracted by something.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's the bit. Because the music is really wonderful. I love the music. But you make a great point, because like it doesn't have to be quite as It can be a bit more subtle, because I think audio really is the redheaded stepchild of video when it comes to that sort of thing anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much of directors are like involved with that, or if it's more of a post-production sort of thing, and you know, people who are making the decisions on that side or whatever. But you know, yeah, you make a great point, David. I agree with that, but I have to disagree, because I love Murray Gold. I think he's great. I really enjoyed like the new theme. I love it.
Well, I didn't like that. You see, in the first episode, I absolutely hated it. Absolutely hated it. And then they tweaked it for subsequent episodes.
It's actually a lot better.
Yeah,
it's great.
I think
as with everything in the new series, it's you know, Murray had been doing it for 5 years. Yeah, he needed a rest. You know, get someone new in, for goodness sake. And I don't really know why they didn't. I really don't understand why they didn't. At least to their own.
Well, their own. Now, he'll be at the proms. Is that correct, the Doctor Who
yeah,
proms?
Yeah, that's right.
He's doing okay, our very own Dale. Dale is actually going to the proms.
Oh, wow. Are you singing, Dale, or what? What are you doing?
No, I'm probably going to be heckling. I'm probably going to be storming the stage and trying to get my hands on Matt Smith.
Okay. We're doing a Jarvis Cocker.
Something with the word cock in. Yeah, something like that. I am debating whether to take K9 to the prom with me, actually. Because I think that's bloody hilarious, him sitting on the seat next to me.
How funny.
Negative, master.
As long as you don't have to buy him an extra ticket. Jeez. But are you guys planning on going, David, Sam?
No, not at all. No, I mean, I think the tickets went on sale, didn't they, Dale? And they were sold out within an hour or something of going on sale.
But, yeah, absolutely. The BBC, for the first time this year, put prom tickets online. And in the first day, considering this is all the proms, they sold 80,000 tickets.
Yeah, it's so popular.
Now, for the Doctor Who prom, this will really get you. For the Doctor Who prom, the lines opened at 8 o'clock. I logged on at 8 o'clock and 3 seconds, and there were already 350 people in the queue.
Oh, my God.
From 8.15 until 8.15 in the evening when they shut it, there was never less than 4,000 people in the queue. For a 12-hour period, and it had long sold out. So you get to it, and then it'd say, sold out.
Yeah.
Wow.
So actually,
you had to wait 4,000 in the queue to get a sold out message.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh boy, that sucks.
It was a free phone number.
Hang on, I want to talk about vampires.
You want to talk about vampires? Okay, go ahead,
Dale. Because.
All right.
Sam.
Go on, Dale. We love vampires. Talk about vampires.
Vampires. Literally, their special abilities and, you know, what some can do and what some can't do and all the rest of it. And they're almost legendary and as wide-ranging as vampires themselves. So what can yours do and what can't yours do in your books?
Well, mine are completely indestructible. You could burn them, you could chop them up, they would just not die. They would be reborn, they would remold themselves in some way or other. They are completely indestructible, which is what I think something of that supernatural nature would exactly be. They're completely immortal, which is a bit
you
of a scary
thing. You can't kill them.
No, yeah, they can't kill them at all.
But the gist of Sam's books, Dale, is that they live forever. You can't kill them, you know, but they are just so incredibly lonely. And, you know, it's like everybody you fall in love with will die. You know? And you try and turn them into a vampire, and they still die because it doesn't work.
Mm.
And Sam's books have got a kind of the three books of the trilogy called the Vampire Gene Trilogy. And obviously that's a bit of a clue there, in that there is this gene which kind of dictates whether or not you will become a vampire if you're bitten or not.
It wouldn't be just anybody. You couldn't just buy anybody and they would turn into a vampire. They have to be from a certain gene pool.
Oh, wow.
And the gene pool stretches right back to Venice.
Venice and beyond.
And beyond, back to Italy. Absolutely. And even to the Viking era, certain king.
But your vampires... I mean, they're kind of human in their feelings.
They
and
are
everything.
Because I think if you live forever, you wouldn't become inhuman. I think you would evolve just like anybody. I mean, we all evolve, don't we? I mean, I'm so old now, but I still think
aren't you?
Absolutely 98, and I'm going to stick by that one because I'll always be looking good if I say I'm a lot older. I am.
That's older,
you still feel young. You know, in your brain, you're still young, but you still learn. And as long as your brain is still functioning and smart, you can still learn and evolve and become a different person as life goes on. And I think these people who are living for centuries and centuries would learn so much and know so much about the world that they would be completely fascinating characters.
That's kind of the nature of the books.
That's the nature of the books, really.
It's exploring the characters and the situations they find themselves in.
So, if your vampires are completely indestructible, they can go out during the daylight as well.
Yes, they can.
And they don't sparkle.
No, they definitely don't.
They're sparkling.
I don't mind sparkling vampires. I just think it's another. I think it's another sub-gene group of vampirism. I mean, there's Mitchell can go out during the day and being human. Yeah. He just puts his shades on. So I can see no reason at all why there isn't another subdivision of a gene group of vampirism that, you know, unfortunately they do slightly sparkle, I'm afraid, oops-a-daisy, but they're still vampires and they can still go out in the daylight. I see no problems with that at all.
But I also think that because of the nature of who they are, vampires are parasites. They're blood-sucking monsters. They need blood to survive. Humans are their food. They are, as you say, the next notch up, if you like, on the food chain. Mm. And so, therefore, they wouldn't really be wimpy about that. They would, if they need the food, they would take it. And now, whether they want to kill to take it is a different matter, in the whole story. I mean, some might do that by accident at first, but then learn that you can actually just feed a little bit, you know, make your position, you know, very private so that you aren't a kind of murderer, as it were.
Good stuff. Go on.
I was going to say, Sam's book's going to take off in a different kind of direction as well in the course of the trilogy. I mean, her vampires... So each book's kind of written from a different person's perspective. And you, so you get different perspectives on what it's like to be a vampire. I mean, the first one's a 500-year-old Venetian vampire trying to find anybody that he can spend the rest of his life with.
Yeah, you know, just a companion that will live.
The second book is kind of the story of his maker and, you know, her adventures.
Well, she was Lucretia Borgia.
Lucretia Borgia.
Kind
of her incestuous relationship with her brother and then how she became a vampire and what that meant to her and what life she then lived, you know, related from her point of view.
Particularly how women were so disempowered in that era as well.
There's a lot of kind of women empowerment kind of stuff in there.
Very much. And the third book, of course, is, there's only one way I sum that one up, really. It's Queen of the Damned meets Quantum Leap with a dash of Hellraiser.
Because we've
time
travel is the third
God knows what, and it's absolutely. I have to say, you know, I'm biased, obviously, but I mean, I've read it, and it is amazing how it brings everything together and ties all of the loose ends up from the earlier books, and yet is a really kind of exciting, readable vampire romp in its own right. I mean, it's very, very clever writing. She's very talented, although she's quite modest about it.
So, Sam, the first book is called Killing Kiss.
Killing Kiss, yes. Okay. The second one is Futile Flame, and Killing Kiss won the Silver Award for Best Horror Novel. For Forward Magazine's Book of the Year Award for the horror category in 2007. And Futile Flame, I'm very lucky to say, has now been shortlisted it's a finalist, for the same award for 2009. We're off to New York very shortly for the awards ceremony, which I'm looking forward to a great deal. And Demon Dance, as David said, brings the whole trilogy together. That's but it won't be the end of my vampires. I'm going to do some off-spin stories after this, of course.
Oh, very cool. So Demon Dance, when was it released?
Demon Dance is going to be available in autumn.
Oh, so it's not out yet. But
Okay,
no. So it will be out in the fall.
It will, I'll keep everyone posted. If you want to invite me on Facebook, let me know that you've listened to the Happiness Patrol, and I will happily friend you.
But only if you listen to the Happiness Patrol.
I'm near 2,000, and I've got a fan page as well. So, you know, if you befriend me, though, I'll be happy to invite you if you're a Doctor Who fan.
So Sam, I have to
be careful when you're saying things like that.
I have to tell you, Sam, that I've read a couple of reviews of this book, and I've talked to some people who've read Killing Kiss, and they basically told me that they picked it up and thought, well, let me read this, you know, it's almost time for bed. Let me read this, and I'll, you know, go off to sleep, that sort of thing. But basically, they picked it up, started reading it, and literally could not put it down and had to stay up all night and read it because it was so engrossing.
It's so funny.
That happens all the time.
We went to World Horror Convention this year, which was in England for the first time. So that was quite an experience, and obviously it was great fun. And we were there kind of selling books, and I think it was on the Friday night. I might get this wrong, but I think it was on the Friday afternoon or something. Someone came and bought a copy of the book from the table. I've been meaning to get this forever, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine, you know, there you go. Hope you enjoy it kind of thing. And then the next day, Saturday, about 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock, they kind of come by the table and look and says, I hate you. And we said, what have we done? And she said, well, you know, I was getting ready for bed, and I just opened the book just to see how it started, as you do. And then I didn't go to sleep till 5 a.m. because I couldn't stop reading it. And that's genuine, honest to truth. People say this all the time.
Yeah, they do.
And it's so funny you heard that as well, Lewis, because everybody seems to say this about
it. It's a strange thing because writing that first book was so... I mean, I've wanted to write a novel since I was 11 years old, to be honest. And I've been writing all that time, you know, never had the confidence to actually submit anything until I wrote this book. And I knew it was good because I obviously had a master's degree behind me to say that this is actually a valid and literary piece of fiction.
Right.
Because my master's degree was in creative writing.
Uh-huh.
And I just wrote this book and I was so proud of it. But writing it every week was just such an amazing experience because... If I tell you it wrote itself, and it just happened, and every single word of it just seemed to be just fall out of me in such an easy way. Like, and I feel that very much. I think the second book was much harder. Futile Flame was so much harder to write.
Now that was
book was the same. It fell out of me.
That was That was the next question I was going to ask you. I mean, with a trilogy. Okay. Now, when you started writing Killing Kiss, I mean, did you expect it to be like, did you have the whole trilogy sort of like sketched out in your head? Or did it just sort of like go, well, you know, I like where this character developed to. I'm going to write a second book exploring another aspect of this character. And then
That's basically what happened, actually, Lewis. It was kind of, I started writing it. My tutor at the time, who's also a literary writer called Jeanette Jenkins, written about 3 or 4 books, great writer. Actually gave us an exercise in the class and said, describe a fairground. And in that description of the fairground, within a 3-hour seminar, Gabrielli was born. And he just became the whole character of the first book. And as I said, the voice of Gabrielli was just born at that moment. And he happened and his story just told itself. And as I got halfway through it, I thought, there's so much more here. And this thing that's unfolding, the vampire gene. And then I actually started to think beyond, where is this going to go? Because I really didn't want to finish writing it. It's a strange experience. I just loved it so much I didn't want to stop.
You've become attached to these characters.
I did. And my tutor, it was the funniest thing, because she said to me when I used to go in every week, we used to read a chapter of our book in the class. She used to say to me, it feels like he's real and he's told you the story. And that is the biggest compliment that any writer can ever get, is that their characters are believable and real. In a way, that's exactly how it felt to me. It was like the story had to be told. And the same with Futile Flame. Before I got to the end, I already knew that there would be a second and third book. Futile Flame was a difficult book to write. Terrible second book.
For listeners of the Happiness Patrol, hardcore Doctor Who fans, what would be the attraction for these people, fans of Doctor Who, to your work in general? What would be the connection there that they would like? I mean, other than just being, you know, fantastic writing, you know, and a jolly good read, but, you know, what do you think connects them?
That's the main thing, I think, Lewis. Uh-huh. Doctor Who fans, in my experience, and I mean, I've been a Doctor Who fan all my life, yeah? I mean, I can't remember a time when I wasn't a Doctor Who fan. And Doctor Who fans are the most discerning, intelligent, and just eloquent and educated people
that
you could possibly hope to meet. I mean, I've been to so many conventions. I've taken part in so many interviews. And without fail, everybody is so lovely. And also the thing that I think sets, you know, hardcore Doctor Who fans apart is that they are not afraid to like other things as well.
Right.
I've had discussions with hardcore Star Trek fans, for example. And I love Star Trek. I have nothing against it.
Oh, you poor dear.
No, it's great. It's great. But these fans, you know, would not concede that there was any other fiction other than Star Trek fiction.
That's true.
Which is kind of weird. Kind of missing out, guys, you know, because there's a whole world of wonderfulness out there.
I think,
you know, Sam's writing, it's poetic, it's very literary, it's very eloquent. The characters she paints are real, and you care about them, and you feel for them, and you know, you go through these times and adventures with them. You know, and hey, if that's not what we do with the Doctor week in, week out, then, you know, it's kind of all the same basic well here.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. It is the same universe, isn't it?
Yeah, it's adventure stories of love and loss and, you know, achievement and sometimes failure. And that's Doctor Who, and that's good fiction. And and that's what Sam's writing, at least for me, you know, embodies, because, you know, she's a very, very eloquent, literary and poetic writer. You know, and some of the work is beautiful. You know, beautiful.
I couldn't say that. I couldn't describe like that,
I think you've got your biggest fan right there in the room, huh, Sam?
She's very modest. She's very modest. You know? And I think writers are. Most good writers are.
Now, Sam, tell me this. Has David ever said to you, you know, I just adore you and I love your writing so much. Why don't you write a Doctor Who story?
Yes. It has many, many times.
So, do you think you would, if you were approached to develop a story for Doctor Who?
I would love to write a Doctor Who story, and I'm working on lots of synopsises in that area at the moment.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Is all I can say.
Stay tuned. Okay. To coin an old phrase.
Yeah.
Are there any Doctor Who references in your vampire books?
Oh, that's a good question.
Well, actually, that's interesting because I hadn't thought it, but in book two, we have Lucretia meets a gypsy called Miranda who has a caravan which appears bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. And I actually didn't make this connection at all, but one of my horror fans came and said to me, you know, one, he loved the book, he thought it was brutal, which was great. I love that. He said it was brutal, but he said that he made this Doctor Who connection. I was like, oh, well, maybe that's completely subconscious. But I think in the third book, with the time travel element, most definitely, I am very much influenced by things that I see on television and things that I watch. I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. And probably there are a lot of elements there that subconsciously have creeped in, even if I don't mean to do it.
But, you know, Doctor Who is the great absorber of culture. I mean, you know, Doctor Who has absorbed Hammer films. It's absorbed, every single storyline that you could possibly imagine, Doctor Who's absorbed and appropriated for its own use. You know, and I think it's only right that, you know, elements of Doctor Who get appropriated for use in other fictions as well.
I think writers do that anyway. We just absorb the world, you know, and whatever's going on around us.
Absolutely.
You know, like I said, there's a little bit of a Hellraiser element in there as well. But
time travel. Yeah. And getting back to Vampires in Venice, I mean, as I said, it is quite spooky that, you know, Toby has picked upon the same kind of setting that Sam used in her first novel. Yeah.
And I don't think for 1 minute Toby's read my book.
No, it's just coincidence. And I think they were saying on the confidential, well, it's just the alliteration, Vampires in Venice. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to have Vampires in Moscow.
That's quite obvious,
you know,
really.
It's going to be the alliterative title kind of thing. And it's great that they've taken the vampire idea and twisted it around a bit and, you know, and kind of made them out to be space fish.
Now, tell me this. Movie-wise, as far as, like, vampires portrayed in movies, do you have any real favorites or anything that that has influenced you or just stood out in any way?
Lost Boys.
Oh, how nice.
Lost Boys and Fright Night. I absolutely adore Fright Night, first one.
Now, it's odd, because when you said that you were sitting in your class and they said, describe a fairground, first thing that comes into my mind is the Lost Boys film.
Well, funny enough, it never occurred to me at the time when I was describing it, oddly. And it should have done, but the fairground I described is one from my own childhood. Isn't that odd? Which wasn't an Americanized fairground, but more of a traditional in-a-field kind of fairground that was in my head. Because it's all, obviously my book's based in Manchester in England, so it isn't Americanized at all.
Mm. Well, Sam's a big fan of Interview the Vampire as well.
I like the film. I didn't like it as much as the book because I think it was just blended.
Cool. Now, do you like Anne Rice's style of writing or?
A lot of Anne Rice, and initially I mean to me Interview was a great book, and I was 18 when I read the first one. Mm-hmm. I read it completely. I mean, this is a great compliment to Anne, I think, that to say this, that it completely changed my life and how I thought about vampires. Book two, The Vampire Lestat, blew me away. It was far better, and The Queen of the Damned went on to even greater things for me. I think later on, some of the books deteriorated. It carried on for about five or six books that I was really happy with. And after that, it got a little bit too historical and a little bit too fat and a little bit too not edited enough for my liking. Right. I wanted.
And now that she's gone round the twist.
What do you mean gone round the twist?
I don't know. I mean, she's very religious now. So.
Oh. She found Jesus.
Oh, she got saved.
Oh, did she? Well, did Lestat have him stuffed down the back of the sofa or something?
Oh, yeah. That's kind of
now, you see, for me...
So, and it took him that long to get out.
I'm going to say, for me, guys, and I don't know if Lewis and Tara, you'd know this, but hopefully, Dale, you would. My favourite ever vampire is the BBC Count Dracula adaptation with Louis Jordan,
which I
absolutely adore. Have you seen that?
I have, and I can't stand it.
Really?
Oh, really? Oh, no.
I haven't seen this. Tara, have you seen it?
From about 1977,
is it? Pictures. Pictures are gorgeous.
Do you know what I think? I think with the vampires, I think it is very periodic. I mean, in the era that you see the film, it is the best thing you've ever seen. And as we move on and we see a different vampire movie, such as Frank Langella, for example, did Dracula.
Oh, yes, he did.
Very sexy.
Oh, he was gloriously sexy.
And very sexy.
Doctor Who tie-in, Sylvester McCoy's in it.
Oh, really? Yes.
Okay. Sylvester McCoy, okay, wait a minute. Sylvester McCoy was in what, Dale?
He was in the 1979 Universal production of Dracula with Frank Langella as Dracula and Laurence Olivier as Van Helsing. There is a fantastic scene where Renfield's going mad in his cell. And Sylvester's out there on the landing and says, I better get the doctor. And I'm thinking, well, that's not a prophecy. I don't know what is.
You're going to have to watch that again now you've said that. I can't remember that.
But coming more up to date, I think we both love the first Underworld film.
Yes.
With a great as in that.
I adore that.
And like I said, it's kind of to do with the area you're in. Blade, for example, I love Blade. I just think...
husband and I have a tradition of watching Blade movies for Christmas.
Oh, seriously, Tara, he's so fucking sexy. I mean, he's great. Come on,
It's very funny. It's very funny. My husband and I, one Christmas morning, got up very early, and my parents were staying in my house, and there wasn't anything on television. We were flipping channels, and I don't know what moron put Blade 1 on Christmas morning, and... husband and I were sitting there watching it. We'd never seen it. And just howling with laughter, slamming down on the couch, laughing. My parents came in, and I think my parents came in at the scene where they're in the slaughterhouse and it's raining blood. And my husband and I were just incoherent with laughter. For my husband and I, Christmas Day, we watched Blade movies.
Oh, come on.
But didn't you think it was scary? Have you seen Trinity, Blade Trinity, the third one? When the shape-shifting vampire turns up as Chris Christopherson, and he just turns around. I actually thought it was really freaky at that point, the first time I saw it. But, you know, there's elements of that are just so exciting, but so fun. You can't, you know, you can switch the box off afterwards and just completely dismiss it.
Well, I have to tell you, I grew up in the 70s, and we saw a lot of, on our local channels, we saw a lot of, on Saturday and Sundays, we saw a lot of Universal films, you know, the classic horror films. And I remember so vividly seeing the very first Dracula with Bela Lugosi.
Absolute favorite Dracula film.
And it's so amazing because he was you know, creepy. I mean, the whole thing was creepy. It had a sense of creepiness, and I think the reason why is because of the lack of musical cues in it.
Yes. Going back to Larry Gold, the point.
You know, and it was like there's this one scene that just stands out in my head where he's like putting somebody in a trance, and I can't remember who it was, but he's like, you know, moving slowly and closer to the camera, and Bela Lugosi's eyes are just big.
They kind of lit them up, didn't they?
Yeah.
That was the only special effects they had.
That was it.
Spotlights at his eyes, and that was it.
And that was all you really need. I mean, because you knew, you know, this person's in a trance. Okay, they're susceptible to the attack of the vampire. So, you know, Wow. And then I didn't get scared after that with vampire movies until I actually had a chance, and I was probably like in my early 20s before I saw it, Nosferatu.
And, yeah, oh, that was horrifying.
Which version?
The very first.
The 1922 version.
Yes.
The Kinski one.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's just shit.
No, well, that was entertaining in its own right, but no, the 1922 one. Yes, yes.
I think I picked up, Lewis, that again, coming back to Vampires of Venice, that Nosferatu was actually set in Venice.
Was it?
Is that right?
I gotta go to Google. Gotta go Google.
Someone said that.
I don't believe it is, because it's meant to be. It was actually based around. It's meant to be Dracula, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
it's
Bram Stoker's widow sued, so they had to change all the names.
Hence it became
Count Orlok.
Speaking of Killing Kiss, I also heard this about your books, that there's a lot of eroticism in your characters.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're sexy,
right, Sam?
They're sexy. Vampires are sexy.
Okay. Now tell me this. Tell me this, Sam. Do you think it is possible? And this is just, you know, something I wrote in my notes, and I was thinking, do you think it's possible to remove eroticism from the whole vampire genre and still have a good vampire story? Or do you think it's nearly impossible? Or do you think the two are so intertwined that it's impossible to do such?
I think it's a very interesting question. I think I'll refer to Bram Stoker's Dracula for this one.
Back to source.
Absolutely. The whole idea of an element of eroticism started in a very Freudian way in Bram Stoker's Dracula, in the fact that they, Dracula, it feeds from the breast, and there's kind of an Oedipal connection there. So I think this whole eroticism leads back completely to mother and child and birth of and creation in general, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah.
But you can have a sexless vampire, because if you look at Nosferatu or you look at Salem's Lot, the vampires in there are not sexy in the slightest, but they are freaking terrifying.
Yeah, the emphasis in the films is the meal, or they are just a completely wild, feral type of beast, and actually, although they have a higher consciousness, they don't really seem to think beyond the eating aspect. I think it depends on the vampire itself.
Hmm.
I think Dracula was more involved than that himself. He was looking for something else.
But even in your book, Sam, I mean, the first book has got, you know, a fairly high erotic content. The second slightly less. The third's got virtually none.
Yeah, except the third book hasn't got hardly any erotic content, because it's not actually.
Why not?
Relevant.
There should be hunky men in it.
there are, but it is actually not relevant to that story that's been told. You see, and the first one, it was relevant. The taking of blood is an erotic element within my stories, because it is orgasmic, because I think in terms of the victim enjoying that experience, it has to be, from my point of view anyway, in my vampire
world. Well, you've got something primal in the whole thing of feeding, number one, sex, number two.
Yeah.
It's just very primal elements.
And the Universal films very well, in the sense of, you know, what is more sexy than some strange, gorgeous guy sneaking into your room and biting you on the neck? Come on. That is kind of erotic.
And again, when you watch the old Hammer Draculas, and you kind of see, you know, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, or... Bride of Dracula, but... whichever. And Christopher Lee kind of... beguiling the young women and kind of biting them, and then they kind of love being bitten. It's all part and parcel of that kind of mythos.
It's a seduction. And I think that makes it, if you think of a cobra hypnotizing its victims, shall we say, before it strikes, do you think its victim feels a strike once it's been hypnotized?
Wow, that's a good question.
I think so.
Yeah, I would think that you're going to feel it.
What was that?
If you had a supernatural cobra who was able to beguile and make you forget that it had actually happened. You know, I think there's a kind of excitement in that, the fact that you can be. I think particularly in eroticism, there's a kind of eroticism in not being able to refuse and being seduced and actually not being in control of what's happening. It's not your fault.
A submissive element.
Yeah, and that could be a male or female thing. It's a kind of definitely an S&M element in that. And blood sharing, which I do explore a lot in the first book, because there is a certain cult of people who believe in vampirism in the world today that actually do share blood. And so I do explore that a lot in the first book in Kin and Kiss. So there is a kind of erotic element in sharing blood and trusting somebody enough. It's sharing bodily fluids in the same way that you do in a sexual way. And of course, those sexy fangs are penetrative, aren't they?
Yeah, missus.
Yeah, I guess the whole.
I guess. Right.
Oh. So that looks
preferably
like
they're not literally.
That's about all the time we have right now for the Happiness Patrol. Thank all you guys for tuning in and listening once again. So once again, we really like to thank our very special guests, Sam Stone and David Howe. Thank you so much for being on the Happiness Patrol.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Sam, is there a website or anything that you'd like to tell the Happiness Patrol listeners about, you know, more of your work?
If you want to catch up with me on Facebook, Twitter, you can do so by visiting my website, which is www.sam-stone.com. And if you do want to buy my books, there's links on there to www.murkydepths.com, which is my publisher's.
Cool.
That's a really good name for a website.
The Murky Depths. So, and you guys, if you want to follow us, the Happiness Patrol, make sure you follow our Blogspot, because there you'll find all of our information and all of our back issues of the Happiness Patrol that you can peruse through anytime at all. Dale, why don't you tell them where that is?
It's Leela's job. Call her up now. All right. It's thehappinesspatrol.blogspot.com. And following from Leela's example, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/thehpatrol.
And if you want to send us some love mail, hate mail, anything at all.
Get well soon cards.
You get well soon cards, because God knows we're going to need that.
Suggestions where Tara can find better porn.
Oh, yeah. Yes. That email is the.happiness.patrol@gmail.com. So until next time, I'm Lewis B.
And I'm Tara W.
And I'm a gondola driver. With the Croatoan virus.
Yes, okay. We'll see you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Happiness Patrol.
Of the Mr. Men. We know that you can hear us, Earth creatures. One day, Mr. Blobby was going down to the shops to buy an ice cream. Anyway, carry on. Whatever.
All right, that'll work.
I have found the ones from the TARDIS. Excellent. I shall take the patrol and destroy them. No, capture them alive. They must be interrogated first. We also need the Time Lord to pilot the TARDIS. See, now I can do a bloody fantastic cyber leader in this voice.
Well, I had to get that mister on, you know.
Now, how close do you need it?
Well, it doesn't need to be that close, David.
Oh, not quite that close.
I could smell the fish custard from here. So, Teletubbies. Teletubbies, I have a whole theory about Teletubbies, David, that they're basically they're children of an alien race that have landed here on Earth. They age incredibly slowly, but the adults will soon come back to get them, you know? And the adults are like really, really scary big time monster aliens. So
they are. But you see, I tend to think of the Daleks now as the Teletubbies, and what's
oh,
that?
Oh, God, yeah, I guess.
I'm going to step back a couple of weeks, and we've got kind of, you know, Tinky Winky Dalek and Poe Dalek.
Oh, no.
And they all come trundling out in their lovely kind of, you know...
which one has the purse?
Yeah, which one has the purse?
Exactly. That would be the purple one, I think.